I grew up in a place called Middlesbrough, which is a large town about 150,000 in the north of England. I love the borough, as we call it. I really do. I go back a lot and see my parents and catch up with old mates. But growing up, I hated it. I remember going on a school trip down in London when I was in my last year of primary school and being amazed at how different it was. We went to see the Science and Natural History Museum, and I was floored before we even walked through the doors. To me, every building in London looked like Middlesbrough Cathedral before it was demolished. We had one nice, fancy-looking antique building in the borough, and then the council decided to take a wrecking ball to it. I think it might have been then I decided that London was the place for me. And the first chance I got, I moved all the way down to the bright lights and sleepless nights of the Big Smoke. I did a media degree. I found a decent job. Then ended up living a few different places until I settled down on a flat in Brixton. For those who don't know, Brixton is probably one of the most exciting, vibrant places in the whole country. It's a real cultural melting pot, known for its great food, great music, and great people. Don't get me wrong, there's a few bad apples in there, but they generally remain sequestered from the good ones, who manage to stay clear of that particular kind of blight. Anyway, after falling in love with the place, I jumped at the chance to get a flat there, but not long after I moved in, I discovered that I had some very unusual neighbors. Having a few weird neighbors is a given in a place like Brixton. If you think you don't have any weird neighbors, then you are the weird neighbors everyone else talks about, I promise you. But things only get weird as, say, playing weird electronic dance music on a Sunday morning. The kind that sounds like R2-D2 is having an epileptic fit. Or someone knocking on your door to ask if you want to join a socialist cross-stitch collective. It's a harmless kind of weird, what I suppose is better termed eccentric. But every so often, you end up living next to the kind of bad weird, as I did between 2012 and 2013. The first time that I noticed something wasn't quite right was in late 2012. I remember returning home from the local boozer, where I'd been watching the football with a few of my mates, when I saw a young woman and older man walking out of the block next door. We crossed paths, and I gave them both a polite smile, which, in typical London fashion, they didn't return. That's one thing I noticed about the North compared to the South. People tend to be a lot more casually friendly than in London, where it always feels like people are a bit suspicious of one another. That means that I wasn't all surprised that they didn't return my greeting, but what really got my attention were the young woman's eyebrows. I'd walked past both of them on a section of narrow pavement, so I'd gotten a good look at each of them as they passed. The fella had this wispy white hair and looked to me to be an Arab or Indian bloke in his 50s or maybe 60s. The woman looked like she could have been his daughter or his niece, but there was also something odd about her. She didn't have any eyebrows. I don't know if this was a medical condition or maybe she shaved them off, but in a place of dark horizontal hairs, there were just two badly drawn lines above her eyes. After I noticed, I tried my best not to stare or anything, then just walked past them and into my building. I think that was the first time I'd seen anyone from that block up close before. The first time I ever noticed anything amiss with any of them. And I know something like shaven eyebrows is odd, but it didn't seem like that much of a red flag at the time. Some people are just a bit weird, aren't they? And if I freak out and start spying on neighbors anytime one of them starts acting a bit odd, I'd have a bit of a running miniature version of the CIA out of my living room. The girl with no eyebrows stayed on my mind, and I told the story to a few mates with this kind of horror comedy tone to it. But if I'd known what was actually going on in that block of flats, I don't think I would have been laughing. The next thing happened when I was on my way home from work. I was maybe only a minute or two away from my flat. There was a woman walking in front of me with two heavy bags from shopping. I'd never seen her before, and I was correct in assuming she was a local resident. But then as we were walking, something very strange happened. Both of the bags she was carrying were each stuffed with food. So much so that as she was walking, something dropped out of one of the bags without her noticing. I was just a few steps away from my block of flats at that point, so I rushed forward, grabbed what I distinctly remember was a 3-pack of bell peppers, and then called out to inform her that she dropped something. She stopped, turned to look at me. Then instead of turning back to collect her wayward peppers, she just kept on walking at a faster pace. At first, I honestly thought she'd misheard me or misunderstood me. so I called out to her again, making it clearer that I was only trying to return something that she dropped. She didn't look at me. She didn't talk to me. She just kept on walking, then turned into the neighboring block of flats that the girl with no eyebrows had emerged from. I stood there with this woman's peppers thinking, what the bloody hell is wrong with people in that block of flats? I didn't know what else to do, so I just left the peppers on their doorsteps in hopes she might realize what happened, and then entered my own block and walked up to my own flat. Just like the girl with no eyebrows, I found the encounter strange but not frightening. I understand it might be a bit intimidating if a man starts calling out to a stranger in the street like that. Maybe she thought I'd snatched it out of her bag and was, I don't know, taunting her with it. I tried to rationalize it because I couldn't quite possibly conceive of what was going on in that neighboring block of flats, but as I think you'll soon understand, I could have taken 1,000 guesses and still never even been close to what was actually going on. The next event took place when I was alone in my flat on a rainy Tuesday night, and I heard what I thought were police radios coming from the hallway outside. I'm not sure if I just watched too many episodes of 24 Hours in Police Custody, but I heard the distinct buzz of their radios, and I just knew it was the police. But then, when I heard them knocking on the door of the flat opposite me, I knew something juicy was going on. I don't mean to make the sound like I'm some massive gossip, but I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. If the police were there, something serious had happened, and I felt it was in my best interest to know what that thing was. And so, I crept up to my front door, peered out of the little peephole, and tried to get an idea of what was going on. My neighbor answered her door right away, and I could tell she wasn't in any distress. She welcomed the two policemen inside her flat and closed the door, meaning I was no longer knowing what the situation was. I went back into the kitchen and then kept quiet as I made a cup of tea. Then once I heard her door open again, I nipped back to the door to earwig again. That's when I heard her mention something about a disturbance in the building next to us, the same building all those people lived in. We have a culture of minding our own business in the UK, and that rule especially applies in London. But having pieced it all together that something wasn't quite right about the people living in the block next to us, I decided to do a little bit of snooping. Once the police had left, I went over to my neighbor's flat, the one in my building the police had just visited, not the one next to us where the weirdos were living. I knocked on the door and introduced myself, then asked if she didn't mind telling me why the police had just been round. She invited me in, then grew quite anxious as she explained what happened. Apparently, she'd been hearing the odd banging sound coming from the flats next door for quite some time, but hadn't wanted to make a fuss about it until she heard screaming. When she heard screaming, I thought she meant like a domestic argument or something out of that nature. You know, man shouts at a woman shouts back at the man. Maybe man slams the door or woman throws a vase. But she didn't mean shouting, she meant screaming. My neighbor said she only thought to call the police because it sounded like there was an actual murder taking place in the room next over. And what's worse is that the police had already called at the block next door, only to find that no one would open their doors to them. She pointed that out, and by the time the police arrived, it had gone completely quiet next door. And we both agreed that that meant either whatever had caused the screaming had stopped, or the person screaming was no longer able to. It made for a grim thought. Some kind of domestic abuse was occurring right under our noses, and there was little to nothing we could do about it. But the reality was much, much worse. A few more months go by. Summer creeps into autumn. I didn't see hide or hair of any of those weirdos next door. I kept up with my neighbor too, the nice girl I mentioned, and she reassured me that she hadn't heard any screaming since that evening. She'd heard other things, sometimes quite frightening things, but no screaming. When I asked her about the other things, she said, singing, but then corrected herself. It didn't sound like singing, so much as it sounded like chanting. If it wasn't obvious that something was very, very wrong with the people in that block, the chanting thing would have sealed the deal for anyone. I asked my neighbor if she was sure it wasn't just someone with a terrible voice, singing in the shower or what have you, but she was quite sure. It was multiple people, it was monotone, and it went on for an uncomfortably long periods before finally subsiding. I asked her how she was dealing with it, and she told me she was actually considering moving out. She was sick of the stress, sick of people phoning the police only to have them do nothing about it. So imagine how I felt when one day I came home to find two police officers stood outside my block, almost like they were guarding it. As I tried to get into my block, one of the policemen stopped me and asked me if I was a resident. When I said yes, he asked if I had the time to answer a few questions. I told him sure, gave him my flat number, and then about 20 minutes later, I got a knock at my door. It was two detectives from the Met, and when I asked what the issue was, they told me they couldn't reveal details of their investigation. They didn't have to, though. Their questions told me almost everything that I needed to know. The first question was something like, "Have you ever noticed anything unusual regarding the behavior or lifestyle of the people next door?" I think they were expecting an answer of just a few words, but I launched into a 10-minute spiel about the girl with no eyebrows, the woman who seemed too scared to talk to me, as well as the weird chants and screams that had my neighbor considering moving out. I told them everything that I knew. I voiced all my concerns, and as one of the detectives listened, the other scribbled down as much of what I said as possible. And once we were done, they thanked me for my time and showed themselves out. But before they left, I asked them once more if they were sure they couldn't tell me what had been happening in the block next door. I'll never, ever forget the look one of them gave me before he said something like, "Between you and me, mate, you'll be reading all about this in the papers before long." He was right. Over the next few weeks, more and more details began to emerge regarding what had been happening in the block next door. And at the center of it all was a man named Comrade Bala, Aravindan Balakrishnan. He'd grown up over in Singapore before moving to the UK. This was in spite of the fact that as a communist, Comrade Bala claimed to hate the UK and all it stood for. He studied at the London School of Economics, got married, and joined the local Communist Party, but was soon kicked out due to his views being too extreme. He then took a little core of his followers and moved them all to a house in South London. I heard there were about 30 of them to begin with, all crammed into this little house they referred to as a commune. But as Bala's rules got stricter and stricter, his views got more and more extreme, and the commune's number shrank to about 10, and somehow, the remaining 10 were all females. To my knowledge, that's when the abuse kicked off in earnest. And after some trouble with the police, Comrade Bala took his commune, which by that point was just him and I think 5 or 6 other women, and then moved them into flats next door to where I end up living. According to all the news stories, this was when things got really, really vile. Bala, terrified of losing his remaining followers, turned to drug-fueled brainwashing techniques in order to prevent women from leaving him. He forbid some of them from leaving the flat and would only let them do so if they were in his company. The women were also forbidden from talking to strangers, which I'd actually witnessed with my own eyes the time I tried to return that 3-pack of peppers. Through the use of things like magic mushrooms, sedatives, and other mind-altering drugs, Bala managed to convince his tiny core of loyal followers that he controlled the sun, the moon, wind, and fire. And the craziest thing is, they all actually believed him. They didn't call him Comrade Bala either. They called him Jackie, which was an acronym that stood for Jehovah, Allah, Christ, and Immortal East Warren. The idea that he was all the gods combined, he had the power to monitor thoughts, control minds, and even stop people's hearts to kill them instantly. But even after reading all that, I hadn't actually landed on the sickest thing yet. Like I said, it took a while for all the details to emerge because social services had taken their time to questioning the women he'd held captive. But as the months went by, I learned something that I hadn't ever been able to get out of my head. Aravindan, Comrade Bala, Jackie, whatever you want to call him, he convinced the women he'd brainwashed that his bodily fluids, yes, you read that right, were tantamount to an elixir of life. He made them drink his urine, sometimes on a daily basis, all as part of his sick regime of humiliation and abuse. I read that 5 women were rescued from flats next door. The one I remember the clearest turned out to be Bala's biological daughter, only she was raised to never know who her parents actually were. I'm guessing that Bala wanted her to think that either everyone or no one was her mom and dad. And as much as that seems like some nice, it takes a village style parenting, I can't imagine how damaging this was to his daughter's psyche. She never went to school, never took a trip to a dentist, and apart from the day that she was delivered by the NHS nurses, she never, ever visited a doctor for any reason whatsoever. Apparently, she was taught to read and write by some of Bala's followers, but I also heard the lessons weren't exactly comprehensive. I think she was in her 30s when she was rescued, but this girl still had a great deal of difficulty in reading and signing all the documents presented to her during questioning. When I finally saw a picture of her, I recognized her instantly. She'd been the same girl with the drawn-on eyebrows, and they were the exact same way in pictures that I saw. I remember that there was an Indonesian or Malaysian woman rescued too, but I can't remember her name off the top of my head. But I suppose that's partly because I remember some of the other women so much more. There was a woman named Josephine, whose dad had done something important for the British government during the war. She was the one who brought the whole thing crashing down, after Comrade Bala refused to let one of them see a doctor. I'm almost certain it was quite a serious condition, maybe even life or death. But it was that which prompted Josephine to call some kind of helpline. This is what the police needed to do their actual job properly. An admission of abuse from the inside, not some neighbor, when eyewitnesses are so notoriously unreliable. Personally, I think she's the hero of the story, at least one of them, because there were others who never made it out of Comrade Bala's cult alive. There was another Southeastern Asian lady, you can Google her name, who died after Comrade Bala refused to take her to a hospital. The death was kept a total secret, and her family only found out she was dead after the police arrested Bala and freed the women. And then there was also a woman named Sayin Davies, who had given birth to Bala's child. After years of horrendous abuse at the hands of her child's father, she tried to escape by climbing out of a third floor bathroom window. She slipped, fell, and went into a coma, and died not long afterward. Bala never even acknowledged her death, not even once. They just went on like she never existed. This whole thing went on for 30 years. 30 years of all these women being abused and arguably murdered, and the police didn't do a single thing about it until things were way too late and lives had already been ruined. But it didn't stop there. Since Comrade Bala insisted he was innocent on all charges, he obviously needed a trial. And I remember quite literally counting down the days as his trial day came up. I had this morbid curiosity to know what was going on, right under my bloody nose. I know I hadn't been there for very long in the grand scheme of things, and that the abuse had literally been going on since before I was born. But I still felt, I don't know, guilty for not having acted on those red flags that I noticed. When it came to his trial, Allah didn't disappoint. He told the jury, and almost every paper reported this, so I'm willing to bet that it's true, that he made the Challenger space shuttle blow up in 1986. Their bloody jaws must have been on the floor listening to all that bollocks. I reckon they decided he was guilty right there and then. He ended up getting sent to prison for 20-something years, but in April of last year, I read that he died in prison. The papers didn't say what killed him, but I remember hoping it was very, very painful. Having seen some of these victims, not to mention the perpetrator, with my own two eyes, I took a great deal of personal interest in the case. As I already mentioned, I followed the trial quite closely, and the news of Bala's death caught my eye on the day that the news was released. I still can't believe that something like that could happen, for so long, hidden in plain sight. It's not even that the police didn't try to do anything either. If I recall correctly, they raided Bala's commune on two different occasions, but what they really needed to bring the whole thing crashing down was someone on the inside to turn on the man they once considered a god. I still think about Comrade Bala and all his victims from time to time, and as horrifying as all these details are, they're not what give me the occasional sleepless nights. The truly terrifying thing to me personally is the idea that there are other Comrade Balas out there, turning the lives of vulnerable people into living nightmares, right under our bloody noses. I was traveling in Asia at the time. I got a tuk-tuk, which is like a rickshaw, to go to the center of the village with a young driver. As we were driving, he turned around while telling me he wasn't going to take me to the center of the village because he knew a better spot in the jungle, a place he and his friends loved. Traveling anywhere, a proposition like this is always a no-no. In Asia, Russia, or the Middle East, it's a huge red flag and could end up being fatal. These daytime drivers, city guides, or whatever they claim to be, no one knows the city or the countryside better than they do. They spent their entire life in the region, and they definitely have an agenda. Letting them lead you away, off the grid, is one of the ways they get ahead. It's also how they get off. Tourists get raped in these countries, left and right, unfortunately. Not in the mainstream visitor areas, but if you find yourself backpacking in regions where no one speaks your language, you'll find yourself looking over your shoulder much more often. I told him no. I told him I want to go to the center of the village, and that's it. He gets angry and sped up. Well, I'm considering my chances of just jumping out. During all of this, he grabbed my arm in this tight grip, and I knew for sure no good would come from the situation. He actually did a good job of keeping me cornered, literally pinned to this piece of shit tuk-tuk. Luckily for me, I had an umbrella with me, and with my free hand, I started slamming him with it as hard as I could, until he finally stopped the vehicle. Now, once he did, suddenly he offers to take me to the center of the village now, and he makes it sound like it's his idea. I can see blood running down his nose. His hair is all disheveled from the absolute blasting I gave him with that umbrella. I laughed in his face. No. I gathered up the meager belongings I had and climbed out of that little street tumbler. The driver cursed me, spat at my feet, and drove away hollering all kinds of nonsense. I didn't really think anything of it. I ended up walking 3 hours to the next village. I had planned on spending one more day there, but was constantly confronted by people saying that I was the girl that attacked the tuk-tuk driver, who offered me a ride. Pretty sure they were all his friends. I don't know how, but I know they were connected to that guy somehow. They were all young men. Same kind of demeanor and look, and same bad attitude. They had to be fellow drivers or maybe regulars he gave rides to. Either way, they headed out for me. And after the aggression that that driver showed me, I assumed these guys might do anything. Throughout the rest of my time there, I stayed in busy areas until I was able to take a train out. It was a nightmare situation, hiding from all these people all that time. I went to university in a town that is surrounded by wine farms. I lived in an old farmhouse with my housemates, and during the summer holidays, we locked up the place for 4 weeks, and then would all go home. I didn't realize I'd left the light on in my room, so at night it must have looked like someone was actually home, but we weren't. This place was rural by nature, so we thought nothing of leaving small items behind or if a single bulb was left on. There was little to no outsider traffic. Mostly just wealthy families and people who worked the land for the wine farms. Maybe visitors every now and again. No one returned to our house for the entire 4 week period. When I got back after the summer, the grass all around the house had grown quite long. The afternoon of the day we arrived back, I was walking around the house to enter inside my room from the outside door, as my bedroom had a door to the inside of the house and a door to the yard as well. When I looked, I suddenly saw a man's body lying face down in the long grass outside of my house. I stood frozen for a moment. I thought maybe it was one of the guys I lived with, because who else would it be? I looked up and down, over and over again, but couldn't recognize a single detail about him. Not the clothes, not the hair, or even the skin tone. Each time I thought I placed who it was, I would start to move forward, but then pause again. This was not a person I knew. I started looking around for anything to indicate what the hell I was even looking at. There were bloody hand marks on my door, dark brown, deep red, and streaked up and down the glass and wood. It had clearly been there for some time, because there was a lot of it. You could have painted the whole door with the residue pooled at the bottom. I quickly phoned the police and the ambulance got there in a panic, but it was clear this guy had been dead for a few days. I followed the steady trail of blood to his body and looked him over again. He was a bit older, dressed plain. There were some tears in his shirt and pants. More pools of blood rested beneath his stiff corpse. Apparently, we got the full story, or at least part of it. He was a farm worker who had gotten into a fight with a friend in the middle of the night, some kind of drunken altercation on the vineyard grounds. They went back and forth until the other guy pulled out a knife and stabbed him multiple times, all up and down his body. He stumbled away from the facility and then through the pasture for a mile or so until he saw the light had left on for 4 whole weeks. He shuffled around to a couple of the doors, knocked, tried all the handles, but no one was home. He stumbled into the yard and bled to death right outside my bedroom door. This kept me awake for many, many nights, thinking that I'd somehow contributed to the death of this man. It's still nauseating to think about all these years later. I think the lockdown affected me more than most. I'd always dreamed of being an actress. Stage, screen, TV, I didn't care. But as anyone who dreams of gracing the silver screen will tell you, breaking into the industry is not easy. I managed to land an odd job here and there, mainly extra work. But to put food on the table, I got a job waiting tables at a Greek restaurant downtown. It was an okay job. The place was family owned and they treated me like I was an adopted daughter. But then the pandemic hit and everything changed. They tried to stay open to pick up for orders, but it wasn't enough to break even. So one day, I got a call saying they were closing indefinitely. They promised to call me when or if the place reopened, but the implications were clear. During one of the most difficult and trying times of my whole life, I'd be reliant on welfare unless I found myself another job fast. I tried my best to find something, anything, that would keep the lights on, but for one reason or another, I fell short time and time again. As I grew increasingly isolated, I got more and more depressed, and by the time I had to consider putting my cat up for adoption, I was on the verge of a complete emotional breakdown. That's about the same time that I first heard about the Foundation. Now, the Foundation isn't this organization's real name, nor do I want to reveal my name or location. I could go into a long-winded explanation of why I want to remain anonymous, but I'd like to think that my reasoning behind that will become obvious as the story progresses. I first came across the Foundation's website after falling down a self-help rabbit hole. I'd seen a lot of pretty out there spiritualist stuff on my digital travels, and I'd never been one for star signs or auras or any of that garbage. So when I came across this self-help organization that presented itself in a very logical and level-headed way, I was immediately interested. I won't bore you with all the intricate details, but the gist of it is that they offered a bunch of self-help programs in the area, such as personal, career, or family development. But what really had me interested were all the glowing reviews that they had. I'm not talking about stuff they put on their website. I'm talking about things I'd heard in various online self-help forums. The Foundation seemed to always get a mention whenever the subject of a successful self-help program came up anywhere. So after checking a few of them out for myself, I decided to purchase one. I had to borrow money from my parents, and the worst part is I lied and told them I was spending it on something else. But the truth was, I sent it right to the Foundation, and they quickly sent over some preliminary course outlines for me to read through. I'd like to be able to tell you that it was all a bunch of mumbo jumbo, but it wasn't. Those course outlines seemed concise, well thought out, and the video seminars were welcoming and productive. And although I'd initially fretted over my decision to send them literally hundreds of dollars, I suddenly found myself with no regrets whatsoever. The courses actually worked for me. They helped me better organize my time. They helped me motivate myself. And when I finally landed a job working from home for a small shipping company, I firmly believed I had the Foundation to thank for all my success. One of my mentors then advised I get into voice acting, and after applying the same kind of discipline and work ethic, I managed to land myself in a side hustle, doing freelance voice work for, well, just about anyone who needed it. Once again, I thought I had the Foundation to thank for my success, and by that time, I'd completely bought into their whole shtick, hook, line, and sinker. So much so that when I finally completed my first course, I signed up for the second in a heartbeat. It was much more expensive than the introductory course, much more expensive, actually. But like I said, I'd completely bought into the message, so a few thousand dollars seemed like nothing to continue my journey. The way my mentor phrased it was, think of it as an investment. You saw return on your first, and you'll see a proportional return on this one too. Upon beginning what they called a purpose program, which was supposed to affirm our vision, direction, and personal principles, I was paired up with a purpose partner. The idea was that unless absolutely necessary, we were to refrain from communicating with anyone but our purpose partner. This way, we could keep each other on track without any undue outside influence that might sap our motivation and skew our direction. Looking back on it, this was the first time they fostered any kind of cult-like behavior, but the way they dressed it up, it looked like nothing more than a harmless buddy system. Everything was so subtle and innocently phrased, but the goal was to cut them off from our family and our friends, so that we sank further and further into the clutches of the foundation. As far as the second investment is concerned, I didn't see the same kind of immediate return, but that's where my purpose partner came in. He was a guy we'll just call Todd, a mild-mannered father of two from the Midwest, who worked a job as a school inspector. He was a great guy, and he assured me that all we needed to do was stick with the program, continue manifesting our goals. It would pay off eventually. Only, it didn't. We came out of lockdown. Acting jobs started opening up again. But once again, I struggled to land anything and began to get very frustrated. I ended up getting in touch with my mentor, who also happened to be Todd's mentor too, and explained my situation to him. I didn't feel like the purpose program was working for me, and I asked him to recommend an alternative course. We then performed what's known as a gap assessment, which seemed fairly scientific at the time, but was probably a bunch of woo-woo. And once it was done, my mentor promised to get back with me with his recommendations. A week or so later, my mentor finally returned my calls, but when she did, she dropped a bombshell. I won't bore you with all the cult speak, but the long and short of it was, my gaps, meaning my flaws, were wider than first anticipated. If the purpose program wasn't working for me for whatever reason, then I obviously needed more extensive and comprehensive mentorship, known as the Personal Effective Levels program. But that mentorship came at a price, and that price was $17,000. I don't know why they picked such an odd number, but it didn't really matter. That was the first time I actually stopped and thought to myself, they don't want to help people, they just want to make money. If they really cared, why not price all the programs the same? They all took pretty much the same amount of time, so why the massive jump in price as you advance through the system? And that's not even touching all the talk of NDAs and mandatory service that would be required of those who reached out to the higher tiers. I told my mentor that I'd think it over, but I didn't really have that kind of money at present, and that I'd need time to get it together before I signed onto the Personal Effective Levels program. Right away, their reply became a little frostier, and I realized they weren't the kind of people who took no for an answer. It was months before I voiced my concerns to Todd, who I'd stayed in touch with following the cessation of the purpose program. Part of me was terrified that he'd chastise me, or worse, share my doubts with our mentor, but he didn't, and to my relief, he'd been having the exact same doubts. That's when I found out that Todd had been in the program way, way longer than I had. And when I was in that hole for a few thousand dollars, Todd had handed over tens of thousands of dollars to the foundation in order to just remain part of the program. Every time it seemed like he was about to advance onto the third development tier, he was bumped back down and made to pay even more money. At first, he'd experienced similar things to me. Increased well-being, a better relationship with his spouse, and even credited the foundation for getting the raise he'd been owed for almost a decade. But just like in my case, the longer he stared at it, the more he started to see the cracks of what the foundation was offering, and how their loving, welcoming veneer dropped whenever it sounded like you couldn't pay up. A few days after our talk, we made the mutual decision to leave the foundation. If there's one thing I can thank them for, it's putting me in touch with Todd. He gave me the strength to do what needed to be done. We supported each other in cutting off all contact. And although that was a depressingly hard thing to do, we guided one another through the process with all we could. We learned not to answer any calls from unknown numbers, how to block spam emails from anyone, except the most reputable of sources, and even how to mask our social media profiles so they didn't show up in any search results. But it wasn't enough, and one day, I found out just how far the foundation were willing to go. To write the whole thing out, it might take another 1,500 words, so I'll just try to keep things brief. One day a few months back, I got a visit from two police officers. They didn't have a warrant, so I guess I could have legally refused them entry to my apartment, but I also have nothing to hide, so I let them in. They told me they wanted to take a look around to make sure everything was okay, as they'd had an anonymous call come in from someone saying they were worried about me. I had a creeping feeling that the foundation were somehow responsible, but I had no idea how. Luckily, one of the police officers shed some light on it once they'd finished looking around. Right away, they asked if I'd made any enemies recently, and when I said yes, that I actually had, they told me what their visit was all about. There hadn't been a call from a concerned relative or friend. The cops had received an email from some random email address, claiming I was, and I'm not kidding here, recording myself torturing animals, then uploading it to the internet for money. The email claimed I was doing it at home, and had been for quite some time. So once the cops seemed happy that I wasn't doing anything of the sort, it seemed fairly obvious what was actually going on. That was only the first stage of the harassment, though. As crazy as it sounds, I actually got lucky, because what they did to Todd was way, way worse. Recalling the phone call I had with him is an emotional experience to say the least, so excuse me if I don't share it in detail. Long story short, someone had organized a series of mass accusations against him, all from anonymous sources. But unlike me, who was mostly victimized using social media, Todd's character assassins targeted his school district with actual phone calls, all of which accused him of being a predatory pedophile. It ruined his life, not overnight. It was a slow poisoning, but they definitely did. The school board's investigation came back clean, but the court of public opinion had already convicted him. He was hounded out of his job, hounded out of the town that he lived in. His wife ended up leaving him, taking the kids after she finally succumbed to all the talk of no smoke without fire. Now Todd won't even answer my calls anymore. His phone rang out for a few days, but now it says it's disconnected. I'm terrified that I can barely even bring myself to say this, but I'm scared Todd might have done something to himself. Something terrible. I really hope he's just simply moved on, and that he made another attempt to switch his cell phone number, maybe even change his name or leave the country. But in my darkest moments, I tell myself the worst has indeed happened. I think that's what the foundation does. They just break them down piece by piece until they go ahead and burn themselves. Todd was a much better person than I, and if they got to him, then it's only a matter of time before they get to me too. I was driving from Georgia to California to visit a friend. I didn't want to fly because I wanted to see the sights on the way. When I got to San Diego, the hotel that I booked on Expedia screamed run from the get-go, but I was exhausted and I just wanted to rest. I got my room key and checked myself in. This was really out of character for me because I usually take every precaution when I'm traveling alone. The worst stories you've ever heard are single women on the road or across the country, letting their guard down for just 1 minute. I'm the type to avoid those situations entirely and will go out of my way to ensure nothing suspicious is going on. Not this time, though. I was just too damn tired. I locked the door, and because I'm always on my guard, I locked the bar and the door for that extra safety. This at least put my mind at ease. Around 4 a.m., I woke up to hear someone trying to come inside my room. They'd open up that door, but couldn't get past the little bar that was locked. I quickly got up, threw clothes on, and went to the door to see what the hell was going on. I find two men outside my door, with their hand in the slit of the door, yelling at me. They kept saying things like, "Come here, pretty girl. Oh, a pretty face." Something like that, with their grimy fingers sliding up and down the length of the frame. I can see the pressure on its hinges and that lock bar from leaning them against the door. I tried to keep an angle to where they couldn't see me. Anytime I found myself a little too far in the wrong direction, I could make eye contact with them, looking me up and down, continuing to say creepy stuff. I couldn't believe the only thing keeping me from being assaulted and murdered was this 2-ounce piece of steel screwed into the door. I quickly called the front desk to see what the hell was going on, and their response? "Oh, I didn't know you were still here." Everything went cold when I heard that. The only people that knew I was locked in this fucking room were the creeps just outside the door, trying to push their way in. Even the clerk didn't seem to care that these guys were trying to break in for God knows what reason. I was beyond furious and went to the front desk with all my stuff. I explained to the creeps outside that I was coming out, and if anyone touched me, I'd fight, scream, and call the police. I told them I'd pull their eyes out if they tried anything. They got a little more serious and gave me a wide berth as I exited. I carried everything in an armload across my chest. This way I could literally drop it all and run if I needed to, and not worry about getting hung up or pulled back by a loose strap. It was all a nightmare scenario for me. So fortunately, I had a few more moves up my sleeve. By carrying that armload in front of me, it was almost like a suit of armor between myself and those weirdos. If they tried to grab me, they'd have a 50-50 chance of grabbing a fistful of random clothing. And in my right hand was my key ring, and each key protruding from between my knuckles. I wasn't kidding when I said I'd gouge their eyes out before they hurt me. The lady at the desk said I didn't even have a reservation, even though I had a paper saying I checked in, my car decal stickers for parking there, and I had a room key. All the evidence I said was in the right, but this clerk almost seemed convinced that I was running some kind of racket, like I scammed my way into the room. She said that the room that I was in was rented out to the gentleman in the hallway for a month, and they were only halfway through their stay. Somehow I'd been rented a room that was already occupied, which explained why both me and them had a key that seemed to work on the door. Completely flabbergasted, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. She looked up my information and said, "Oh, I see you didn't book with us but Expedia. We don't partner with them." I'm still confused as to why in the world I was given a room and then paid for it, and then had issues with being in it. She refused to call her manager at 5 a.m. at that point. So I waited until they got there at 9 a.m., demanded a refund, got it, and then checked out. No matter how terrified the whole ordeal seemed, it definitely would have ended differently had I not locked the bar on the door. I might just have been a headline in the newspaper that I'd never heard of. I was an exchange student in China around the year 2000 with a fellow buddy of mine. Our hotel was on a very big, 6-lane, brightly lit street, with half of the other people being foreigners as well. At around 10 p.m., me and my mate decided to go out and find something to eat. At an intersection, we found this smallest shop, bought a snack, and asked around with super limited Chinese and English, and ended up finding someone who spoke English, the niece of the shop owner. She was super young, but spoke very good English, and said she could direct us to a very good and cheap restaurant. So we agreed, and she led us down the street into the non-tourist part of the city. It was interesting how the surroundings changed after just a few minutes, and we were the only foreigners on the street, and a lot of people were staring. The buildings became more run down, and the place wasn't as brightly lit, but still kind of charming. I could tell we were out of place, to say the least. But we put a lot of faith into a girl who looked like a kid, all for a cheap bite to eat. She continued to talk to us, ask us questions about where we were staying, how long we were staying, what our plans were. She mentioned a few times that she was studying at the university and was 21 years of age. This raised a few alarms with me, but me and my mate didn't want to be rude. We were just hungry. Still, I couldn't help but wonder why any of this was important information. I guess I was just being critical, but it seemed like oversharing and almost overcompensating for something. It made me think she was actually younger than she looked. After about 15 minutes, we arrive at a very small and somewhat charming restaurant. I don't know the proper name for this kind of shop, but at least in China, or at least the city that I visited, there were a lot of these shops in these little prefabricated houses, like trailers. Each house had two smallest shops on the street level, and you could see all sorts of businesses in these. Some were bigger ones renting two adjoining ones to form a bigger shop, and you just go on from there. You could assemble any manner of commerce with these kinds of assemblies. The restaurant was in one of these half-size stores. There were just four tables, and one counter to the kitchen in the back, and one video game machine. With the help of our translator, we ordered and then she excused herself. Not gonna lie, we low-key kind of felt abandoned. I'd think we'd be able to find our way back, but it was clearly local territory. We didn't know what dangers could be out there, what else to look out for, and we barely spoke the language. My anxiety grew as we waited for our meal. To her credit, the food was super good and cheap. We got this massive bowl of ramen, a heaping dish of different dumplings, and several beverages for no more than 25 or 30 bucks. It was a knockout dinner to say the least, so I felt bad for questioning our guide and doubting her intentions. So far so good, right? But what made the whole situation strange was several other factors. For one, the other guest in the restaurant looked straight out of a crime flick, and they were talking about us, quite obviously, pointing and laughing. One of them had this bad knife scar on his cheek, the other broken nose, and a third one, I kid you not, had on an eye patch. It got crazier the longer you looked. They had these jagged scars along their throats too, and one guy was missing more than half of his ear. These were serious crime affiliates, and this was their local choice for dining. While we ate, we continued to see a lot of people just gawking at us. Especially noticed something like these gangbangers that were staring us down. They were four younger kids with matching leather jackets and short cropped hair. They were patrolling the streets at least four times while we stayed there, and always looked straight at us while they passed the shop. Things were seeming to get out of hand, and there wasn't just one, but like five red flags for us to break out and run for our lives. After we ate and paid, all of a sudden out of nowhere, the 21-year-old translator turns up again, inquired if the food was good, and then offered to take us to some very good place for a lot of fun. We declined and thanked her, but said that we would just return as we were both tired. She continues to fast talk us, told us about a party, beautiful women, younger girls. But when we saw those same kids again, we waited, and exactly 60 seconds, then bailed out of there. Both of us had been counting how long it took them to make a lap and then circle back. It wasn't long, and we figured a minute was long enough to get them far away in the opposite direction. She followed us, seemed very frustrated, even panicky that we left so suddenly, and tried her best to convince us to follow her. We got out of there as quickly as we could, though. In high speed mode, we made it back to that big 6-lane main road and said our goodbyes to her. The whole situation was scary and just really seemed sketchy. In hindsight, they were probably just very nice people. We've just never seen foreigners in this part of the city, but those younger kids, the quote-unquote cliche pirate at the end of the table, and the shady way that that girl tried to goad us towards God knows what place, while overly stating that she was 21. All of this together just led me to the conclusion that we got out of there at the right time. Something was definitely amiss that night, and later on we learned that the area that we were in was infamous for sex trafficking, sex work, and all kinds of underworld crime. I swear, some places never see the light of day. Backstory really quickly. We live in apartments and we mostly know everyone. It was Thanksgiving week. I'm usually late for shit all the time and had a long road trip ahead of me to see my partner's family. Somehow, I'm actually early, and we're leaving on this trip with really good timing. I load up my car. It's all packed. Pets are in, and we're ready to go. Well, some girl I've never seen before comes out of nowhere looking super worried. She walks up to me and my girlfriend and tells us that she needs help. She starts crying and says it's this guy. At this point, some random old dude was walking up behind her, and we legit almost replay that scene from SpongeBob where they beat up the old dude. We just kind of share this look like, Are we about to do this? But we have some clarity. We really don't know what's going on here. I ask the girl what's wrong and ask her if someone is trying to hurt her. She composes herself a little bit and tells me and my girlfriend that she's worried about her ex. They had a lot of problems and it was super toxic and she cut all communication. Apparently the guy had emailed her that night before coming over and that he can change. The usual weird shit abusive people say. She wanted me to go knock on his door so that she could know that he was alright. It turns out he's my next door neighbor right down the hall. Our apartments are actually touching one another and are only separated by a thin wall. Now the dude that she's talking about is someone that I knew because he always walked his Dalmatian and our dog would play with each other. I was used to seeing this guy, so I thought it really can't be that bad to knock on his door. Still, this is Texas. People have guns, so no way in hell I'm opening any doors. I go and grab a staff member, and he tells us not to worry. It's the holidays, people party and drink and fall asleep. I tell them that this chick is kind of freaking out, and we should at least call the police or something. As we walk to the apartment, we talk to that girl again. Her story seems to be the same and legit, so I said, whatever, let's at least knock on the door. I knock on the door and hear this dog barking. I see the lights on, so someone's definitely home. My job is done here, right? But no, something just doesn't add up. His dog was barking, but not coming to the window. No one responded to the door, so maybe something is going on. The girl had permission to enter, since the email said something along the lines of, "Please come check on me." It sounded pretty sketchy to me, but the property manager said it legally checked out and unlocked the place for her. Once again, this is Texas. No way I'm opening up the door, so I tell her I'll go in with her to check on him, but she has to open up the door, just in case they start blasting or something. The manager takes several big, healthy steps away from the door and the windows because he's a Texan too. He knows he just opened up a door to a total stranger. She opens up the door, but begins freaking out again, telling me she can't go in there. She tells me to go look because she can't. Man, I hate helping people. So I take a step in. The lights are on, but there's nobody home. All the doors are open, and I see the dog in the restroom. The restroom is usually where people you see dead in the tub, so I definitely didn't want to go in there. But the dog had been in a cage for who knows how long. Come to think of it, I had been hearing a whining dog all day long. Lots of weird loose ends were starting to come together. I've been next door to a dark, dark secret for a whole weekend at this point. So I'm preparing myself for the worst. I look in the bedroom, nothing. I open up the door to the restroom because it was already slightly open, and all I see is a dog in a kennel, surrounded by shit because it's been there for almost 2 days. I see the bathtub has the curtains closed, so I say screw it and quickly pull them open, and lo and behold, it's empty. There's no one here. I have a huge sigh of relief and just say out loud to myself, thank God. Then I go open up the kennel for the dog to get out, but when I turn around, right behind the bathroom door that I just pushed open was the dude hanging there. Holy shit. This is someone I knew. That I interacted with at least daily, and he's now dead as hell. He wasn't even really hanging, I guess. He was kind of squatting down with his neck tied to the door. His eyes were gruesomely popping out of his skull, looking right at me. The string or whatever he was using around his throat was cutting in so deep that I could see veins bursting just under the skin. This has all fucked me up because I guess I let my guard down, so it was really extra shocking. It went from, everything's okay, to shit completely hitting the fan. At this point, I walk out with the dog. I look at the girl and just shake my head. The girl runs in to see and has another huge breakdown, which is completely understandable. This next part is a blur for me, but I remember telling my girlfriend not to come in. I pull my belt off and use it as a makeshift leash for the dog and just walk the dog around the complex. My first reaction was just to walk the dog. I didn't know what else to do. I felt like a crazy person out there. I go back and the girl and the apartment staff had called 911. The dispatcher told the girl to try and resuscitate the guy, but come on. There's no way. That dude was gone. That poor girl had to cut him down. and then try to bring his cold, dead body back to life. Her screams are still nightmare fuel to this day. We told her not to, but in her state of shock, she was just following orders. The guy had been dead for at least a whole day. If you've made it this far, nice, I'm happy to share my crazy Thanksgiving story with you. For a couple of months, any commotion would sort of put me in a panic state. Thankfully, I'm better now. I can look back at this and count it as just a crazy story before we traveled across the country. Something also worth mentioning. Something weird had happened the night before. I was standing in my room and I felt someone shove me forward. I turned around expecting to see my girlfriend, but she was in the kitchen. Legit asked her if she had just pushed me, and she looked at me like I was crazy. I really don't believe in stuff like this, but maybe it's just a weird coincidence. I don't know. Hey everyone, thanks for listening if you stuck around to this point. If you haven't yet, please hit the like button, the subscribe button, and that notification bell to be notified when future episodes come out. If you have a true scary story of your own, feel free to send it to my email or post it to my subreddit. You can stalk me on Twitter, you can stalk me on Facebook, and you can also stalk me on Instagram. All these links are below. Hey everybody, what's going on? I hope you had an awesome and fantastic holiday, Christmas season, and New Year. I know I definitely did. I kind of went radio silent all last week. I had intentions of posting, but then we had family pretty much here the entire week last week, and I never really got an opportunity. And when I did, it just was too loud and lots of bullshit and excuses. Later, I was just like, fuck it, I'm taking the whole rest of the week off. Gonna give that to myself as a Christmas and New Year's present. I know I've said it multiple times and many times up until this point that I'm gonna be doing at least bare minimum 2 episodes per week, and that is 100% still happening no matter what, starting in 2024, which it is 2024, and moving forward. So you get true scary stories today. Thursday will be Alaska horror stories, which taking a week off honestly really benefited me and Zach, the dude that's been finding stories for me as well, so that now I'm kind of like a week ahead on stories and I won't have to wait, you know, on him to get me these stories during the week. So now technically we're a week ahead on stories so that I can guarantee that they'll be out Tuesday, guarantee they'll be out Thursday and moving forward. And I think we've also narrowed down exactly the type of stories I know you guys want to hear and that I want to hear, because I'm kind of a fucking fickle, picky when it comes to it, but it is what it is. I like what I like, and I know I feel like I got a pretty good idea what a majority of you guys like. I know there's still going to be some people complaining and whining, whatever, like there always is going to be, but I've got a pretty good idea of what I think you guys like for the most part, because it's pretty much the same thing that I do. Let me think here. I don't think there's really anything else, man. I'd like to say I'd do more live streams, but that probably isn't going to happen until I get this studio. I'm in the process now of finally getting a studio, so, or at least in the talks of it. Once that actually happens, I might have more opportunities to do so, but it's just too damn loud in my house late at night when I want to do it. You probably hear my daughter screaming right now. Outside of that, I think that's it, man. Definitely go check out Chilling if you haven't yet. This should be the year to do so. I'm over there. I'm one of the narrators. And there's a lot of talent over there. So go check that out. And again, I hope you had a fantastic holiday season and a New Year's, and I'm looking forward to everything we're going to do together and experience together here in 2024. There's a lot more to come. Good content coming, better content, more content. I'm excited for this year and for this channel and for everything else. All right, guys, I think that should be it. I'm done rambling. Have a good Tuesday, and I'll see you on Thursday for Alaska Horror Stories. Cheers.